All right, Joe, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show today, Adam Morrow is going to be back. He writes for IPS News out of Cairo, Egypt. We'll be getting an update on the counter-revolution there. America and Saudi Arabia's counter-revolution, that is. Also, Jeffrey K. will be back on the show. He writes for dissenter.firedoglake.com. And at least he used to write for Truth Out. I'm not sure if he still writes for Truth Out, but he's a psychologist. And man, in fact, if you go and look at his archive, he writes about some outrageous stuff, but a big focus on CIA torture and such like that. So we're going to be talking with him about this new report from this task force. What is it called? It's the something, something. The Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers. God, are we living in a science fiction dystopia or what? Well, anyway, they're trying. They're pushing back a little bit against the conscription of doctors into the government's torture program. And yes, they're army doctors. I don't mean that they've been scripted out of civilian life, conscripted out of civilian life, but just, I don't think that's probably why most of them signed up for the military, would be to help torture people. And I'm sorry, I cannot wait. If you don't want to hear Jeffrey K's interview, whoa, how did my levels get so low over there? Someone been messing around with my thing, man. If you want to hear Jeff K's interview spoiled, listen. If you don't, then go away for a second, because I just have to say this. I can't stand to not say it. Medical professionals were in effect told that their ethical mantra, first, do no harm, did not apply because they were not treating people who were ill. Oh, yeah, this isn't practicing medicine. You're just helping us torture someone, doc. You see? It's like a whole government full of Bill Clintons. Well, that depends what is means after I hold it down and rape it and bite it on the face. Yeah, do no harm. No, that's when you're helping someone. This isn't helping someone. This is torture. So, we're all good. Thank goodness. Well, you know, this is what Antonin Scalia said about the Eighth Amendment and torture, was that it bans cruel and unusual punishment. Not cruel and unusual interrogation. So go ahead. Torture them all you feel like. Oh, America's signature to the anti-torture statute and all those federal statutes enforcing that, enforcing the war crimes laws, etc., etc., all the other criminal statutes that apply to torture. Oh, no, those don't count. Never heard of those, Antonin Scalia. What, he's just an associate justice of the Supreme Court. As far as he knows, there are no laws against torture in America, just the Eighth Amendment, which has no teeth in it, and by the way, only refers to punishment, not questioning. I wonder if they talked about that at the First Congress when James Madison proposed the Bill of Rights. Hey, we need to make sure and leave a loophole in the Eighth Amendment. We can still torture people while we're questioning them. We just can't sentence them to a life of torture after they're convicted based on the confessions we torture out of them. I'm pretty sure that's close to the exact words of the Eighth Amendment, right? Oh, you can torture them, just not after you convict them anymore. Then, well, you can lock them in solitary confinement for 45 years until they die. But other than that, Isn't that in the Eighth Amendment? Didn't it say that?
Yeah. Anyway.
You know what I wonder? I'm sorry I'm blowing the whole interview with Kay coming up, although he's going to have lots of things to say. I'm only blowing my part of it. I wonder, how can you tell if your doctor, your wife's doctor, your cousin's doctor, your kid's doctor is a former CIA torturer? Well, I'm an ear, nose, and throat man now. I did spend a few years torturing people to death for the CIA. Well, actually, my job was keeping them just this side of alive, which is nice. They'd put the oxygen sensor on their finger, and then as soon as they're in the, quote, death spiral, oh, at that point, we let them breathe and electroshock them back to life, slap them around a little bit more. But don't worry, it's not in violation of any ethics, because we're not treating these people as patients. We're just torturing them. Sounds good to me. In fact, now that I think of it, in my mind's eye, which is based off of the what I imagined from the book rather than the movie, in my mind's eye, I think O'Brien, the torturer in 1984, I think he always wore a white lab coat. A doctor's coat. Is that described in the book? Has anybody read 1984 recently? Does Orwell describe O'Brien the torturer as actually wearing a doctor's white coat? Or is that just my imagination? And do no harm doesn't apply to enemies of the state anyway. So. God dang. How far has America fallen? Not sure. Could have been that we were down here all along with the torturers. I mean, you do hear things like, yeah, the Supreme Court finally took America out of the same category where it existed only with Sudan as countries where children can be sentenced to death. You know, that was only like 10 years ago, 12 years ago or something. Maybe 15. Yeah, America, Sudan, and Israel, the last countries who won't sign the cluster bomb treaty. You know, stuff like that. There's a few different ones. You hear them from time to time. But, as somebody was pointing out in an essay I read, I lost track. But they were saying, you know, this is what the U.S. State Department... Oh, I know what it was. It was about the criminalization of Glenn Greenwald's mate, David Miranda, and how they're calling, and they read into, I don't think the actual paper has been published, but they read into the record this UK government paper stating that revealing information with a political agenda to do so that they would construe as with an intent to cause harm to the society that they claim to be the protectors of, that counts as terrorism. Right? Now, of course, all 7 billion people on Earth know that the definition of terrorism is violence against innocent people in order to provoke a political reaction one way or the other. Huh? Don't we all know that in whatever language you speak out there, even the deaf, they know it in sign language. Everyone knows that releasing a document or publishing one or conspiring with a newspaper to publish a document that a leaker had leaked is not terrorism. Only in the lies of the UK government, acting, of course, on behalf of the US government as well. And then the fun part is, this is the kind of thing that America attacks other countries for. I don't know of any, even Sudan, do they use doctors to torture people in Sudan? That might just be America there. But a lot of this stuff is the same stuff that you can hear on a regular basis. The State Department criticizing China for. Criticizing places like Sudan. And saying, hey, let those journalists out of jail. You can't call journalism terrorism. Not if you want an IMF loan. But then who's setting the standard? The most powerful nation in the world. We're number one and all of that. Just like that great story from McClatchy Newspapers from yesterday or the day before about the rapid spread of drones across Latin America. You don't hear about that very often, right? We know that the Israelis torture the Gazans with these things all day, and we know the Americans torture the entire Middle East from Morocco to Pakistan, basically, with them. But apparently, from Mexico on down, governments have taken up the drone for use in harassing and pestering and oppressing their people, interfering with their legitimate drug businesses, etc. It's horrible. But America sets a standard. And everybody else is just racing to keep up. And you know, it won't be long now before China starts using drones to kill Uyghurs. And maybe Tibetans. Or maybe nationalist Chinese, citizens of Taiwan. Who the Chinese state considers enemies of their state wherever they travel somewhere in the world, and they start using drones against them. I shouldn't use China as an example. On one hand, I'm trying to appeal to your, look at it from another point of view. What if it was this other country that you kind of fear a little bit? But I'm not trying to reinforce fear of China because that's stupid. I just mean, it's on. What's to stop it now? What's to stop Vladimir Putin from bombing Dagestan and Chechnya and, for that matter, Georgia with drones when he feels like it? Hey, there's enemies of Russia there in Osetia. Some friends, some enemies. We just kill the enemies. Like the Americans do. That's the law. What America says. I got to say thanks, actually, to the people who produced the show Dukes of Hazzard when I was a kid, starting when I was 7. No, maybe starting when I was 6. It just came on at 7. Anyway, I loved that show when I was a little kid. Loved it. And my very first understanding of the law wasn't free men agree in some legislature on how things ought to be. My first understanding on what the law was Boss Hogg saying, I am the law. Big, fat, corrupt pig here to take what rightfully belongs to you at gunpoint. Yeah, exactly. Just like in real life. There's no such thing as the law. That's just a nice word for excuse. An excuse for someone with power to do what he wants with somebody else. America proves that on the American government proves that on a daily basis. Here and abroad. In fact, I think they actually never stop proving that. In fact, that may be their whole point. Maybe the U.S. government is run by a bunch of anarchists, and they're just trying to impress upon us the fact that they hate us, that they are our enemies, no matter how much we try to love them, and that really we're all much better off without them. Yeah. Maybe not. Although, that might be the effect of it. I used to joke that George Bush was actually a libertarian, and he only did what he did to Iraq because out of the silver lining, we were going to learn the lesson to mind our own damn business. Government can't do what it claims it can do, like remake somebody else's society with bombs into a happy new form of the future and whatever. Freedom on the march and all of that. I mean, not that it was worth it to kill so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, but it turned out that even though I was joking, of course, he's a sick, evil, nationalist, imperialist, mass murderer, and he did it for his own good, he thought, because he's stupid. But in effect, he did what I said he was doing. teaching the American people that, you know what? You're no good at being global cop, Mr. Wannabe Global Cop. So knock it off. And plus, whoever heard of a cop that had to pay his own way as he's out harassing everybody? Well, America can't afford to dress up and act like a cop no more. I mean, you know, you got to admit that what just happened a few weeks back in Syria, not in Syria, in America in regards to Syria is almost a miracle, right? I mean, who would have thought the American people could say, no, we don't want a war, and then could stop one by saying no? Holy crap. And that was because of George Bush, the backlash. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe the worse they get, the closer we get to a free society again. Although, I don't know. It's probably going to get quite a bit worse before it gets better. Speaking of which, Houston cops shoot guy in wheelchair. He's in the hospital. Of course, the hospital staff called the cops on him because he was screaming and yelling and pissing people off or something like that. So they call the paramilitary death squad. Oh, gee, I could have swore that I saw on TV a hero was going to come and save everybody. But instead, the right-wing paramilitary death squad showed up, the local chapter of the Wolf Brigade. And they shot this paralyzed, limbless, well, double amputee. He had lost one arm and one leg. Shot him in the head at point-blank range because, according to them, he had a pin. Not a pin, which could be very, very scary. A ballpoint pin. The guy is paralyzed. The guy is a double amputee. The guy is in a wheelchair. And the cop shoots him at point blank range in the head. The grand jury no-billed it. Internal Affairs, if they even looked at it, one or the other different parts of the police asked him, well, yeah, but did you feel like killing this guy? And he answered, yeah, I felt like it. And they said, that's good enough for us. No charges. Come on. Not even the possibility of charges for a cop who shows up and doesn't even have a chance, right? This isn't one of those times, you know, because every single cop is just waiting for a chance where he can kill someone and get away with it. Pretend like, oh yeah, no, it was a legal shot I took. They're all just waiting for the chance to murder someone, you know, because they're psychopathic murderers, all of them. But then in this case, this wasn't even a chance. This was a double amputee, paraplegic, in a wheelchair, with a pen. Cops shot him at point blank range in the head and killed him. And the grand jury, you know, handpicked by the prosecutors, no-billed this cop. Hey, look. It's not like the cop would have shot the guy unless he felt like he had to. So case closed. That's it. Go home. You're welcome for your paid vacation. Now get back out there. And, you know, sorry, I wish I could say that the problem is just me and the chip on my shoulder and my hyperbolic tone, but no, really, the guy was paralyzed, double amputee, in a wheelchair. Somehow we've got to break through this theory that police are the people's security force at all. It's just not true. They're our enemy. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. We're at Liberty Express Radio, No Agenda Radio, Anomaly Radio, and et cetera like that. Full interview archives at ScottHorton.org. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. If you go to fff.org today, you can find my new article that's actually from July, that was actually written in April, called Stupidity or Plan. And it's basically my telling of America and Saudi Arabia's counter-revolution to the Arab Spring. I know some people say that America's behind the Arab Spring all along and all of that, and I would say you need to learn to discriminate. The Arab Spring started out as Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions against their American-backed sock puppet torture dictators. And then the Americans and the Saudis got their act together, hijacked the one in Libya, turned on to Syria, got rid of Saleh. They had to sacrifice Saleh the pawn in Yemen, which I didn't get to cover this in the article, but they only replaced him with his cousin or his best friend or whatever from the same regime. They held a one-man election, which Hillary praised as the dawn of democracy in Yemen, and the war continues there, of course. But they helped the Saudis clamp down on the Bahrainian majority that was pressing, and it wasn't really a revolution in Bahrain. It was just a protest movement. They wanted some reforms and were brutally put down by the Saudis and the Bahraini Sunni minority kingdom there. And anyway, so the story is it's about the half-successful counter-revolution, I guess. It's something, whatever the hell it is. It's my review of American foreign policy for the last couple of years is what it is. Stupidity or Plan. It's at fff.org. You can also find it on my Facebook page today. And, you know, you might like it. I don't know. I like it. If you just search Scott Horton, Stupidity, I bet you'll find it. I mean, Scott Horton, Plan. Yeah, all right. All right, so here's some big news. Antiwar.com, as you may know, was under investigation by the FBI and is now being represented by the ACLU and suing the FBI over that. They were even using their counterterrorism powers, which has a much lower threshold than probable cause, just an objective belief. Not that they had an objective belief, but they were acting as though they had, satisfied this lower standard of evidence. And they're using their counterterrorism powers against antiwar.com. This is really why I lost my job there, because when that story broke, important donors said, I can't do this, man. The FBI is messing with you. I am not. Goodbye. So there's a story out in The Guardian today by Spencer Ackerman about it, and there's a lot of facets to it that I can't get into all of it. But a big part of the FBI's quite illegal surveillance and investigation of antiwar.com, again, illegal because they're using their counterterrorism and counterintelligence powers against an American media organization, was based on complete stupidity. Eric will be on the show tomorrow to explain, Eric Garris. But anyway, here's what happened. On September the 12th, 2001, somebody sent a threatening email to Eric. Eric panicked. He, you know, I'm sure he'll tell it this way tomorrow. It's the way he told it to me. He looks back on it now. It's kind of stupid. He shouldn't have done anything. But at the time, everybody was kind of wigged out. September the 12th, 2001, somebody sent him this threat. So he forwarded it on to the FBI. Hey, look, this guy sent me a threat. Well, some idiot at the FBI says, look, Eric Garris is threatening us. It was a threat to take down the antiwar.com website. They took it as a threat by Eric to take down the FBI's website. And then they used that completely stupid, wrong interpretation of an email, like a freaking first grader mistake here. And they used that as part of their basis for an investigation of antiwar.com that ran for apparently approximately 6 years. 6 years. Until 2008. And then finally the San Francisco office apparently shut down the Newark FBI office's investigation here. But anyway, all along we've known that, according to their documents, they were investigating because somebody went to a right-wing racist rally and somebody mentioned antiwar.com. That may have been back during the Kosovo War or something. And then somebody went to a peace rally in England and somebody mentioned antiwar.com there. And then apparently they were investigating, and I may be a little off here. I believe it was something like they were investigating a Pakistani American who, I don't know if that ever went anywhere, and he had looked at antiwar.com before. Huh, really? And then so I don't know how far they went, but they talked about opening investigation to who all donates to antiwar.com and all the rest of this stuff. These are our protectors. Hunting down media organizations based on they don't have the first freaking idea what they're talking about. Oh my God, I can't believe Eric Garris would threaten us like that. Yeah, maybe that's because you need to reread what that thing says in front of you, stupid. Reminds me of that one time where the FBI agent lady told the reporter, well, what did you expect us to do? Call every flight school in America asking them if they had any suspicious Arabs there? yeah. Yeah. Hate these people, man. They're just so horrible. The FBI, and you know what, if you ever talk to a former FBI agent, and I've talked to a few on the show, as you've probably heard, they will all tell you, the FBI leadership cares only about one thing, their own ass. That's it. The FBI, that's it. If they had to burn down the entire United States of America, kill all of you and all your children, in order for the FBI to still be standing strong, that's what they would do. That's what they are. They're a state within a state. They're our national police force. The Gestapo, the people who created it, swore it would never be. It's exactly what they are. Completely out of control. And completely worthless at their supposed job. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. First guest up today is our friend Adam Morrow. He writes for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net out of Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
Good. Good, Scott. Thanks. Glad to be back.
Good times. Very happy to have you back on the show. So I guess start where you want. Give us an update on America and Saudi Arabia's counter-revolution in Egypt.
It's not going so well for the counter-revolution these days, actually. The reaction that the popular reaction that they've seen, that we've seen in Egypt, to the military ouster of the elected president, that's almost 4 months ago now. Mm-hmm. Was much greater than they ever anticipated. You have these demonstrations are continuing every day, especially on Fridays, that are drawing tens of thousands of people out on the street. The thing is, it's impossible to gauge exactly how massive these demonstrations are because they're hardly receiving any media coverage. The Egyptian media, the private media, and the state-run media are studiously avoiding showing any kind of pro Morsi activity. So it's difficult to gauge how big they are. Gezira, remarkably, the Qatar-based satellite station is the only channel that's really devoting a lot of time to them. And from what you can tell from Gezira, I mean, they appear to be pretty big, especially on Fridays. They appear to be massive, and they're not subsiding. I mean, a lot of people were saying, you know, after these things would all of this would sort of fade after 1 month, but if anything, the momentum seems to be growing. Opposition to this Egypt's new military-backed rulers seems to be growing every day. So they seem to be in a state of confusion.
Mm-hmm. And now, so as far as the military junta's promise that they're going to hold elections and that they don't, I guess Sisi, he doesn't want to be the permanent new Mubarak, or is he still saying that? Does he want the power for himself, or what do you think is going to happen there?
This issue of his presidential ambitions has received a lot of attention. There's, you know, there are leaks that are coming out that suggest that he does have presidential ambitions, and then he's also gone on record as saying that he doesn't have presidential ambitions. However, the idea, according to this political roadmap that the army imposed immediately after Morsi's ouster, it sort of stipulated in very vague terms that parliamentary and presidential elections should be held. I don't think it even gave a time frame. What I think is going to happen is they're not going to hold elections. They have this perpetual excuse that they're fighting a war on terror. This is what they're doing. This is, you know, they're basically trying to portray the demonstrations. Well, basically, you have two different things going on parallel tracks since Morsi's ouster. You've had demonstrations that have been, for the most part, have been peaceful. By and large, have been peaceful demonstrations all over the country, in Cairo and Alexandria, as well as a lot of the most of the other provinces. And those have been going on, like I said, on a daily basis, and they tend to peak on Fridays or on other important occasions. It looked like there were going to be massive demonstrations. What, the day before yesterday, when Morsi's brief court appearance, and I think one of the reasons why they quickly adjourned the trial proceedings until January was because huge numbers of people were starting to hit the streets. So you've had these daily mass demonstrations that are continuing and just gathering momentum on one hand, and then you've also had violent acts. You've definitely had acts of violence, but the perpetrators of those acts of violence remains unknown, and most most of those acts, like 90% of that stuff, is taking place in Sinai, in the northern Sinai Peninsula, mm-hmm. Where it's very difficult to tell exactly what's going on, you know, because news is so slanted and it's so difficult to get, you know, it's so difficult to get reliable information at this point. So it's very difficult to tell even who's carrying out these attacks. But you do have it, these attacks have been occurring on an almost daily basis. They've kind of slowed down in the last week or two, but you've had some quite spectacular attacks. Like they've hit big military intelligence headquarters in South Sinai just maybe 2 weeks ago. So you have these two things sort of going on simultaneously. You've got these nonstop peaceful protests going on, and then you've got attacks by either hardcore Islamist supporters of the opponents of the military coup, or it's some kind of false flag activity which the government is orchestrating so it can then paint the Islamists as terrorists and then hit them back, or it's a combination of both of those things. It's very difficult to tell exactly what's going on.
All right, now. So to backpedal a little bit here to the support for the Brotherhood and the people out there protesting, if we can go back to 2011, I think the way you explained it then was the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't necessarily the people's choice, but they certainly had a big leg up on being an organized group outside of the state. They were illegal but tolerated, basically, under Mubarak. And so,
yeah, just very quickly, Scott, they were the only viable opposition force for all those decades. I mean, they really were the only real, genuine opposition, by which I mean they hadn't been co-opted by the state. You did have a bunch of other so-called opposition parties, but these were all in bed with the state. These were allowed to exist only in order to give the impression of a multi-party system. Right. They were only there to legitimize the ruling NDP, which at the end of the day always controlled everything.
Sure. And by the way, up until the Arab Spring broke out, that was fooling nobody, right? Nobody believed that Egypt had anything democracy.
Well,
it was a one-man dictatorship.
It was the fiction that sort of everybody politely believed. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe Hillary would claim that, but no one on Earth took that seriously. But the point I'm trying to get to, I guess, is when we're looking at all the people protesting now, I would guess that this is a symptom or a result of the way I believe you explained it to me back then. It wasn't just that they had no one else to turn to but the Brotherhood for a center of power outside of power, but that the real, at least, I don't know, super majority, but at least a good majority of the people of Egypt actually supported the Brotherhood. Not just because they were the only alternative, but because that was, in fact, what they wanted. And so they didn't I think part of the spin here is that, well, they took advantage of their superior organization to basically hijack the revolution from the people who revolted. And to hear John Kerry tell it, before and I guess again this week, all the military was doing was saving the revolution from these backwards kooks who had sort of who were lucky enough to be organized enough at the time to do so, but weren't really representing in any way the will of the people of Egypt.
Right. First of all, though, I'd just like to point out, but you can't, how much of a kook can you be if you're really organized? I mean, those two things kind of contradict one another.
Well, I don't know. Look at Pat Robertson and them, right? Like, if they took power in America, we might say, well, they sure are organized, and they sure are nutso.
That's true. Okay, touche. However, I'd like to point out, though, a lot of people a lot of attention has been placed on the presidential elections and Morsi and his 1 year on the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
He won by a slim margin. He beat Ahmed Shafiq, who was Mubarak's last prime minister. He beat him by an extremely slim margin of something like 52% to 48% or something like this. And a lot of people will point to that and say, oh, this was just a fluke. You know, he just won because nobody else wanted Shafiq. And all of this stuff. When I think it's instructive to also bear in mind the parliamentary elections, which happened at the end of 2011 and very early 2012, when you had, I think that is a better gauge of sort of, you know, the popular will, to use an expression that's being bandied around like crazy here by both sides, constant references to the popular will, constant attempts to speak for the Egyptian popular will. But in those parliamentary elections, you had 75% of parliamentary seats went to Islamists, you know, and that was a free election. That was a perfectly free election that was monitored by, you know, international supervisors and all of this sort of thing. And the Islamists picked up 75% of the seats. Now, that wasn't all the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood picked up, I think, a little bit more than half, a little bit above 50%. And then other allied Islamist parties got another 25% or so. So, I mean, like you just said, I mean, you've got a situation now where this new military government is basically trying, they're not only trying to get rid of the Brotherhood, but they want to completely erase or delete political Islam from Egyptian political life. They want to completely erase it from Egyptian political life. And you're talking about a current, you're talking about a political current or an ideology or however you want to describe it, that took 75% of parliament in the last free elections. So you see what kind of sort of impossible situation they're in right now.
Yeah, well, and, you know, of course, the impossible situations are spread around pretty evenly, too, right? Because all of the socialists and unionists and April 5th types who came out and helped the military with the PR stunt that they needed with the big protest, the not as right. big protest, but the renewed protest at the beginning of the summer, who helped the military to overthrow Morsi. Now, what do they have to gain?
They've all been completely screwed, Scott. It's incredible. You know, April 6th people are being rounded up and interrogated and stuff like this. What we're seeing now is, because this was a counter-revolution, you know, they try to tout it as a revolution, as a popular revolution and all this stuff. But it was a counter-revolution, pure and simple, and you can see how they're trying to even change the history of the 25th January Revolution. They're trying to turn that into something that was maybe directed by foreign, that had foreign hands behind it and that sort of thing, and that the June 30th Revolution is actually the real sort of expression of the Egyptian popular will, which is incredible. I mean, they're literally trying to, they've stolen, you know, the revolutionary rhetoric and that sort of stuff, and they're literally trying to basically turn January 25th on its head and make it look like January 25th was some kind of aberration that the June 30th revolution has somehow corrected. It's remarkable, and the way the media has gone into overdrive to push this stuff on everybody. Although that being said, a lot of people have wised up to the media. You talk to most people now on the street and stuff like that, and even pro army people will say, "Look, the media's."
They should have blew it last July, man. I'll tell you what. I mean, anybody could have said, hey, liberals, maybe you don't like the Muslim Brotherhood, but you really want to support the military and canceling the election and maybe having another one sometime again in the future if they feel like it? I mean, boy, did they blow it.
You basically got rid of a president that, okay, you didn't like, but A, won fair and square, you know, was elected fair and square, even if you don't like him, and B, can be voted out. Can be voted out of office if he sucks. You know?
And I'm sure that the Brotherhood did plenty.
You traded that for a fascist leadership that can't be voted out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and the Brotherhood must have, you know, not done the best job at relations with the Cairo left there or whatever, but I don't know.
Sure. I'm gonna say both sides are culpable, though, at the very least. I mean, both sides are culpable. I mean, the behavior that I saw from the left and all of those people has shown me.
They're more culpable, really. They were the ones out in the street saying, "Yeah, cancel the election." So it's all on them, really.
They didn't enter the whole democratic, at the risk of sounding corny, they didn't enter the whole democratic experiment, in good faith. That's how I felt. They didn't go into it in the spirit of, people sort of working together to get the country back up on its feet. It was immediately, immediately go on the offensive. Do everything you can to weaken, the guy who happens to be in power right now, and I think they've paid dearly. The whole country has paid dearly for the choice that they made, for that decision, that's the short-sightedness of that move.
The Copts, or at least the leadership of the Coptic Church, got up there on the stage with the coup leaders and all that last summer. So,
oh, definitely. So did the head of El Azhar. That was those two guys basically gave the coup the religious cover that it needed. You had the Coptic Orthodox Pope, and you had the head of Egypt's El Azhar. El Azhar Institution, which is a big Islamic learning institution here, that's well known throughout the Islamic world. So you had those two. You had the Christian and the Muslim leaders sort of coming out and giving their blessing to the coup. And I'll tell you, there have been massive demonstrations going on in El Azhar. I think I don't know if you know much about El Azhar, but that it does play quite a prominent role in Egyptian politics.
No, I don't know. You're saying that's a university?
It's a university, but it's bigger than just a university. It's like this learning institution that's been around for centuries, several centuries. Mm-hmm. And over the last, since Nasser's time, has been deeply co-opted by the state to the point where Mubarak was appointing the heads of El Azhar, and even the guy who's still head of El Azhar, the guy who was there blessing the coup along with the Pope, was a Mubarak appointee. So this is one of the things I could never understand after January 25th, how you could still have so many. It would be like 2 years after January 25th, and I remember thinking, why are these Mubarak appointees still around, the head of El Azhar, and that prosecutor general that was so troublesome, if you remember, was a Mubarak appointee as well.
Like Obama keeping Gates. You can't even change administrations too quickly without it blowing up in your face, I guess.
Right. And what I've heard is after the July 3rd coup, I heard, like, just from anecdotally from people, Yanni, from people who knew people, that a lot of the guys who had sort of been on, voluntary vacation for the last 2 years, a lot of the Mubarak, state apparatus people were like, went right back into business, without missing a beat. You had a lot of these Mubarak era officials and stuff like that, like going right back to work. You know what I'm saying? It was like the deep state was like on vacation for those 2 years until it, managed to get rid of Morsi, and then they just went right back into business. Interestingly enough, I know we rag on the New York Times a lot, but their coverage of Egypt has been really, really good. People should have a look at some of that. Mm-hmm. They've done some really good stories on Egypt post coup.
Well, I think it's interesting, as you noted earlier, that all sides really are blaming America for this, right? The dictatorship's conspiracy theory is that the CIA is behind the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course the Muslim Brotherhood's conspiracy theory is that America's behind the military dictatorship. I'm leaning toward the Brotherhood's conspiracy theory, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
But it's interesting that overall Uncle Sam is the perfect bad guy, the great Satan to what used to be our most loyal and stable ally in the Middle East there.
Right. Well, what's so hypocritical of the coup people is that, which are basically the Mubarak people, is that the Mubarak regime was suckled on U.S. largesse for American largesse for so long, and then to turn around when it's politically convenient and play the anti-American card just to sort of get street cred or whatever. It's just very, very disingenuous and very hypocritical.
Well, now, so what's John Kerry doing in town? It seemed like he's trying to smooth things over with the Saudis, and I'm thinking telling the Egyptians that, hey, we're in it with the Saudis, with you, that was the mission, to try to get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, that seemed to be what he was very conciliatory when he was in Cairo. I didn't really have a chance to follow everything he said when he was in Saudi, but I know when he was in Egypt, he was surprisingly conciliatory and said good, said that Egypt was on the right track and, this sort of stuff, which shouldn't really come as a surprise.
Which is just amazing that they can go on TV and say that. No, this wasn't a coup, simply because, as everybody knew, is completely you know, understood by all that the only reason they won't call it a coup is because the law says that if you do call it a coup, then you can't sell them as much weapons anymore. And that was the only reason. And the fact that, and then, you know, for Kerry to say that the coup was just the restoration of democracy, and for him to now come out and say, yeah, everything is on track. I mean, yeah, if this is the British Empire, I guess.
Right. Yeah. No, it's pretty shocking. I know there was a congressman, though. I just caught a little bit of this. This was like a couple of days ago. I don't know if you know anything about it. A congressman came out swinging pretty hard against the coup in Egypt, though, and saying basically saying American U.S. policy towards what had happened in Egypt was really shameful and stuff like that. I don't know if you know anything about that. I think he was a congressman from Virginia or something like that. Okay. But I know it is still a source of debate. I mean, I know it's still a source of debate inside the U.S. You know, this is another thing, is that this whole Egypt situation, because then I know this is something I keep harping on, but because Egypt is so big and so important, so geostrategically important, what's happening in here really is having or going to have repercussions in other countries and stuff like that is definitely going to be felt in other countries. Yeah. I know a lot of people in the Gulf. I heard at least that a lot of people in the Gulf were very, very upset with their respective governments, especially Saudi, mm-hmm. for coming out in support of the coup. And even I think in the wake of the Rabaa al-Adawiyya massacre, which happened on August 14th, which was when several hundred pro-Morsi demonstrators got gunned down when a sit-in was dispersed in Cairo. If you remember that, the Gulf countries actually came out and reiterated their support for the coup, which was pretty shocking. You know, basically condoning the murder of these, like, you know, hundreds of peaceful protesters. Pretty shocking stuff. So I think that pissed off a lot of the people inside of Saudi, or at least that's what I heard. I mean, it's created sort of opened new rifts, you know, or it's exposed a lot of people. You know, this is one of the things a lot of people are saying, that this, as bad as everything that's happened has been, it's at least it's taken the masks off of a lot of people. A lot of people who had called themselves liberals and who had touted themselves as liberals in the past like that have been shown up as nothing more than fascists now. At this point, you know, when push comes to shove, we'll openly, you know, support a bloody coup against a democratically elected president and stuff like that. People who used to coup, who were calling them liberals, calling themselves liberals and Democrats until you know, recently.
What was Saudi influence like in Egypt before the coup of the last summer? Or in fact, what was it like under Mubarak?
What was Saudi influence like? I mean, it wasn't felt. I mean, I know Saudi was very pro Mubarak. I think they flirted with the Brotherhood as a fellow, you know, just for their own Islamist credentials, they might have had to pay some lip service to the Muslim Brotherhood. But when push came to shove, when Mubarak was ousted, Saudi's displeasure was very, very well known. I mean, I heard that, you know, Egyptians in Saudi were suddenly being treated like garbage and stuff like that right after the January 25th revolution. I mean, Saudi was absolutely furious, and Saudi was trying desperately to get Mubarak out of jail. I know that was one of the fact that it seemed like every day that he was in jail, it bothered them, you know, like they wanted him out absolutely as soon as possible. I wonder if the money that they granted might have had something to do with getting Mubarak out of jail. Because Saudi and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates have together pledged something like $13 or $14 billion to Egypt.
Which had a lot to do with America too, because I think when Obama was under some pressure to somewhat curtail weapons, right? No F-16s, right, but we'll give you some howitzers or whatever the compromise was. That the Saudi answer was, don't worry about the Americans, we'll cover the loss. So that's not just covering the loss, that's also filling up the power vacuum and kicking us out a little bit. But you know, I want to ask you too, going back to 2011, think of how powerful Al Jazeera was in promoting the original Arab Spring uprising in Egypt. And you know, I read a bit, and I'm sorry I don't know nearly enough about this to even question you well. But I wonder if you know about the split, or at least former split, between the Qataris and the Saudis on the Brotherhood, because it seems like Same story with Egypt. We hear that the Qataris are back in the Brotherhood and the Saudis are back in the al-Nusra guys in Syria, that kind of thing. And then in this case, it seemed like the Qataris were on the side of the Brotherhood and the revolution back in 2011. But then I read something that said that the father has been kicked upstairs and the son is now ruling Qatar, and he's much closer to the Saudi position and is willing to forsake the Muslim Brotherhood to support Sisi in Egypt and the Nusra guys in Syria.
Look, I've heard similar stuff. I'm not an expert on Qatar at all, but I have heard similar stuff. I think it's extremely significant that the crown prince became the emir, they got a new emir, a new prince, a new king, days before the coup in Egypt. I mean, the timing was incredible. It was like literally 3 or 4 days before the coup, maybe 1 or 2 days before those decisive June 30th protests that culminated in Morsi's ouster. All of a sudden, Qatar had this incredible leadership change. I don't know what that means, but I think there is some kind of relation. I've also heard that there is some kind of major rift inside the royal family itself over the issue of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood. I've also heard that.
You were saying earlier in the show, Adam, that Al Jazeera are the only ones covering the Brotherhood protests at this point.
Yeah, well, this is what I was going to say. I have not noticed any discernible, and this is really the only thing I have to base it on, but I haven't noticed any discernible change in Jazeera coverage. You know what I'm saying? If anything, they're like turning up the heat on Egypt. I mean, it's like a war between Jazeera and Egypt right now because, I mean, they have two of their guys were arrested, and I think they're still, in Egyptian in Egyptian custody, you know, a couple of cameramen and a reporter or something like that. And they closed their offices in Egypt a while back, and I think they picked all of them out of the country, but they're still managing to do, and I'm talking right now about their live, it's called Gazira Mubasher in Arabic, and it's their live Egypt channel. It's devoted entirely to Egypt, and it's like 24/7 constant news. So it's quite a good station. I mean, if you're following Egypt news, it's really good for, you know, for breaking developments and that sort of thing. People here hate it and say that it's pro Brotherhood, which it is in a sense, but at the same time, it's also quite reliable. But what they did is basically the military authorities here are jamming their signals constantly, so you can only get them on some, you know, channels, but on other channels they'll be scrambled all the time. And Gazira actually, like 2 or 3 weeks ago, actually did this incredible report where they showed exactly where the Egyptian military were jamming their signals from, like literally showed them, like brought Google Maps and showed the exact locations of these military transmission areas that were actually responsible for scrambling Gazira's signals, which was just incredible, you know, like really, really showing up the military. And then, like 2 weeks later, there was an actual attack. There was some kind of RPG attack. It was like the first attack of its kind in southern Cairo in the Mahdi district, and somebody actually fired an RPG through one of these big satellite transmitters. So it's like, I mean, the whole media aspect is a big part of what's going on. This whole media war is a big thing because you have Al Arabiya, which is a big Saudi channel, mm-hmm. which is based in Dubai.
Hey, I'm sorry, and we have no time at all, but can you talk for about 25 seconds about Morsi on trial and what that means, what he's charged with?
Sure. Morsi is charged with, I mean, what can only be called trumped up charges. I mean, he's being charged with inciting the murder of protesters during some demonstrations last year, in which 11 people were killed, and 8 of the people that were killed in those demonstrations were Brotherhood people. So yet he's being charged with inciting the murder of these demonstrators. So that's like completely nonsensical. And he's also being charged with conspiring with Hamas, which also is ridiculous considering that he was a president at the time and he's allowed to talk to foreign powers.
Yeah.
So the trial proceedings have been delayed until January 8th. So
right.
They'll resume
Thanks
in January.
Thanks very much, Adam. Adam Morrow,
sure.
Everybody. IPSnews.net. Appreciate it. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Me. All right, man, this is the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. This is Scott Horton Show. All right, I wrote a thing. I don't write too much, but I wrote a thing. I wrote it last April. It ran in the Future of Freedom last July. And it's on the Future Freedom Foundation website today. It's just, sorry, I bit my tongue and that messed up my talking right. It's on the Future Freedom Foundation website today. It's titled Stupidity or Plan? And it's my telling of the Arab Spring and America's reaction to it. And you might like it. You can find the archive there at fff.org, or you can find it on my Facebook page, facebook.com/Scott Horton Show, or my Twitter page, twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. I posted it there. Again, it's called Stupidity or Plan. Scott Horton on the American Middle East thing. I'm a jig. And of course, not of course. Here's something you should know. There are two footnotes at the bottom. One of them is updating the fact of the counter-revolution in Egypt, the military coup against Morsi in July. Like I said, the article ran in July. It was written in April. Because you know how it is with print publications. And then also it's been updated to point out that Obama tried to get away with bombing Syria for a minute and then was talked right out of it. And how the UN is now dismantling the chemical weapons. Which just went to show my point about they don't know what the hell they're doing in Syria, which is why it all makes so little sense. But anyway, stupidity or plan? That's my piece today at fff.org. And yeah, it's a little bit out of date, but you know what? There's some interesting stuff in there, and I updated it twice, so it's updated. All right, that's all I got to say about that. Now, someone was asking me about Kokesh and what I think about Adam Kokesh pleading guilty to the D.C. gun charge. And I'm not exactly certain on all the little bitty details. He was charged with the mushrooms in Virginia because supposedly, allegedly, he was in possession of them at his house in Virginia. But he was charged with racking a shotgun in Washington, D.C. He's been held without bail, like he's some kind of dangerous terrorist felon or some nonsense over obvious peaceful civil disobedience. This government, they're so out of control. And anyway, they're holding him without bail, which, you know, I'm sure he's doing fine in the local lockup, no big deal, but he was facing some prison time. And apparently, and I don't know this, I'm only going off of reading between the lines of the headlines today. Apparently, he's pleaded guilty to stay out of prison. Time served will be plenty, thank you. And I can't blame him for that. I am certain that he would never and certainly has not, and hell, I'm the only one even bringing this up. I haven't even heard any, no one's even accused him of this, but I'm just bringing it up just to knock it down. That he's not ratting on anybody. He's not going to flip state's witness and tattletale on anyone for helping him go commit an act of civil disobedience or anything else. But maybe if he can plead to, hey, I won't make it a pain in your ass and make you have to try me, I'll just go ahead and plead guilty if you'll let me off a time served instead of going to prison or something along those lines. Hey, I think that's perfectly justifiable. You know, nobody asked him to go rack a shotgun and get arrested in an act of civil disobedience in the first place. It was, you know, not my thing, but I think it was the right thing to do. It was certainly not the wrong thing to do. Some people disagree with Kokesh's tactics, but I don't really care about that. I like the guy, and I think he means well, and he was doing what he thought was the right thing. And he had backed down from his let's all march around D.C. with rifles thing that very well could have gotten somebody hurt. He didn't do that, you know. He didn't even make a big deal out of it when he racked the shotgun. All he did was videotape it and then go and post it on YouTube from somewhere else. It's not like he went out in front of a bunch of cops and, you know, created a crisis or a possible one or any sort of thing. I've been holding him without bail this whole time. And I say, you know what? The whole thing's his idea in the first place. To go up there and get himself arrested. So whatever punishment he's deliberately getting to make his political point that he should not be punished for such things, since he is, you know, a naturally born free man and all that stuff. It's up to him to judge how much time is enough. If I was Harry, I would say $50 in time served and you're free to go. And then can I have some of those mushrooms? Not to consume on my property or anything, but, you know, maybe somewhere else in a hypothetical situation. So anyway, it's not like he's tattletaling on anybody, and it's not like his goals would be any better accomplished for him to go to actual prison over this thing when, you know, civil disobedience like this, it is what it is. I'm not trying to downplay it, but I'm trying to put it in the proper context. It's like a very serious publicity stunt, right? You know, like if a nun goes and breaks into a nuclear missile silo and she knows she's risking real prison time, it's to bring publicity to the fact that, hey, some humans are holding others hostage with H-bombs. What the hell is this? And she's willing to risk serious consequences for that. It's a PR stunt, but it's serious business. It's not to take away from it, but it's just to point out the purpose of it. The purpose of it is bringing the attention. Suffering in prison unnecessarily. Or how about this? Suffering in prison could be unnecessary to bringing the amount of attention that needs to be brought compared to the act and the consequences and all that. You understand what I mean. I'm not very eloquent, but I've got a point and I think I sort of kind of got it across there. What's he supposed to do? 5 years? 10? Let him get out and then let him get back on the air. Teaching people about what it means to be free and stand up for yourself from time to time, you know? That's my take. And also, by the way, I don't know a whole lot about this. I'm really bad at libertarian movement stuff. I really should be better about the whole libertarian movement. But there were some discrepancies about money issues. People donating to him, and then there were crises about his helpers doing things with the money that they weren't supposed to do or something along those lines. I'm not accusing anybody. I'm just saying you may have heard there was a little bit of a something about that. However, I interviewed his friend Drew Phillips, who he's known for a long time, and I guess not through politics, but who is his real friend in real life, and who was working with Adam's father on taking care of all the money and all the lawyers and all of those things. So if anybody's donating to his defense fund, I think that they can be confident now that whatever monkey business was ever going on there is over. Those people who were screwing around have been frozen out, and now it's his trusted friend Drew Phillips and his trusted father, his father, who are taking care of the deal. So that's worth bringing up, because I'd hate to think that people are refraining from helping him unnecessarily. Any of those problems you may have heard of, I think have all been put to bed now. All right. Stick around. Jeffrey K is coming up here in a minute. We're going to be talking about the CIA torture doctors. Yeah. Well, you do live in a totalitarian police state, so don't be surprised. Jeffrey K coming up here in just a minute. And speaking of living in a totalitarian police state, you may have heard this story of the guy who was pulled over coming out of the Walmart, and they claimed that he was clenching his lower cheeks Oh yeah, if you got kids in the room, they're gonna want to not. You're gonna want to them not hear this. A one and a two and a turn off your noisemaker. Okay. So what these cops did is they raped this guy all day long. They took him to a hospital where the first doctor said, oh, hell no, man, I'm not participating in this at all. So they took him to another county where they had no jurisdiction, to another hospital where the doctors went right along. The experiment requires you to continue, or whatever. And the doctors, see, here's the thing. They didn't just strip search the guy once, which is already extremely problematic if it was you that they were violating, right? No, they raped this guy in the rear, basically, all day long. The cops and the doctors at this hospital. The first thing they did, according to the first news story I read, the first thing they did was x-ray him, and the doctor said there's nothing there. It's an x-ray, dude. You know, like Superman. You can see through people and stuff. And they could see there was nothing there. But on the so-called suspicion of drug possession, the cops mandated, and apparently they had a judge sign a warrant in a completely different jurisdiction, to search the guy, and then x-ray him again, and then search him again, and then x-ray him again, and then search him some more, and at some point, the search was recategorized as an exploratory surgery type operation up into his lower intestine. Because the cops just knew that there are some drugs up there. Oh, yeah. Well, leave it to Will Grigg. He's got the detail. Because you might have been wondering, why did they do that to that guy? I mean, we know that all police are murderers, but are they all homosexual rapists? I mean, that's kind of strange. I know. Rape is a violent crime, not a sexual crime. Anyway, why would they do this to this guy? Well, now we know what it is. And I know what you're thinking. Well, he must have beat up the judge's daughter. Or he must have, you know, hurt someone and got away with it in the past. Or done something terrible, right? Well, here's what it was. A week before he'd been pulled over on a traffic ticket, the first in the series of two. It's not that this guy was a problem on a routine basis. Don't assume that. He had been pulled over on a traffic thing, and at some point, the cop had said he was free to go and then kept questioning him about whatever it was. And the guy asserted his rights and said, well, am I being detained or am I free to go? And the cop responded, well, that's rude. Like, this is all about the cop's feelings rather than the rights of this individual at the hands of this state agent. And the cop got really upset. Oh, so now you want to be a smart guy and ask whether you have the right to leave or not, huh? What? What is this, the fifth grade playground? And so that's what it was. A week later, they saw him again and said, there's that guy. That guy that dared to talk back. That guy that dared to ask, well, wait a minute, am I free to go or not? Let's get him. And so they did. Deming, New Mexico. And here's the thing of it. No one's being prosecuted for this, and no one will be prosecuted for it. If you think any of these cops or the doctors or the nurses or anyone who participated in raping this guy all day simply as an act of revenge for the slightest of standing up for his slightest act of standing up for himself in the face of these bullies. No, you're crazy. No way. They have a license to murder you and the youngest person in your family. If they feel like it, they can shoot you in the head and kill you. Of course they have the right to rape you all day. That's nothing. And then you gotta love the doctors. Are these the CIA doctors now that they're back in regular practice? Who are these doctors? Where, hey, as long as the deputy sheriff says to stick my hand up your ass, that's exactly what I'm gonna do. In fact, over and over and over and over again, all day long, pretending I'm looking for some condom full of cocaine that I've already verified is not there. It's torture and rape. That's what it is. And kidnapping and whatever other assault, whatever other felonies. Each and every one of these cops and the doctors and the nurses, everyone involved in this, should all be doing life in prison without parole. You know, where they can be held down and raped and see how they like it. And everybody knows that. It's a scientific fact. It's an objective mathematical truth of the world. That these are the lowest scum of the earth on the planet. Rapists. It's a crime to rape people. Did you know that? Did you know that the law on rape doesn't say unless you're a cop? That's only just the interpretation of the judges. The law actually doesn't say cops are free to rape whoever they feel like, if they feel like it. Because, you know, if they actually wrote that into the law, why, I don't know, what are you going to do about it? They'll kidnap you and rape you and shoot you in the back of the head if they want. But anyway, I guess they go for the soft sell when they can, so they pretend like it's against the law for anybody to rape anybody. But what they really mean is, it's against the law for a private citizen to rape another private citizen or a government citizen. Government employees, of course, being their lives and their rights being worth 1,000 times any of ours. Just try it. Rape a cop. And see what happens to you. Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonks.org/liberty. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, welcome back to the show. You know, I don't know, man. This is one of those out of sight, out of mind things about the cops, man. As long as they're out persecuting somebody else, we all just kind of cross our fingers and try to keep our head down and hope they don't come for us. But it seems like that ain't much to count on. I get the same feeling when I go to hospitals, you know? If a friend of mine is sick and I go to a hospital, I see all those sick people in the hospital and I just think, man, the whole world is going on out there without them, and most of us are trying to not even consider the fact that all the poor, miserable, sick people who are stuck in the hospital out there today, if they're not people that we know, we just, you know what I mean? Kind of out of sight, out of mind, and we all just sort of pretend everybody's healthy and we hope or something. Same kind of thing with police abuse. And I'll admit it again because I keep thinking of it, so I guess I'll say it out loud because that's how I am with pretty much everything, that I'm afraid of the police. And I'm afraid to talk about them the way I talk about them. I keep doing it anyway out of some stupidity or because I think it's just the right thing, and so I'm doing it in spite of the fact that I'm afraid of them. And I'm not trying to say that, oh, yeah, they care about me a lot because I'm such a big deal or anything like that. But I'm just saying, they kill whoever they want, and they do it every day. Every day I read about cops killing people. Every day I read about cops killing people. You know, the one the other day I skipped where the cop walks into the Quickie Mart. No, black guy starts walking out of the Quickie Mart. Sees a cop coming at him with his gun drawn. Black guy starts backing up, back into the store and down the aisle, down the first aisle. He wasn't hiding behind a further aisle. But he's just trying to put a little bit of distance between himself and this cop. He's not being aggressive. He's got both hands up. He's walking backwards down that very first aisle in front of the window there. Cop comes in, just shoots him in the stomach 4 times. It was amazing the guy didn't die. He, you know, I guess the cop was a lousy shot. He was trying to hit him between the eyes and in the heart. And the guy, you know, is complete and total mistaken identity. This is not the suspect you're looking for. He wasn't doing anything. In fact, I guess the thing I read said he had lowered his hand because he was going to put his money in his pocket, probably pull out his ID. And he just didn't imagine that if he moved his black hand, the cop was going to shoot him. Hey, whoa, what about you got to wait till you can see the gun? And it's a clear and present danger to somebody and something. Not just, oh, you got a license to kill black guys now. What the hell? And this goes on every day. And it ain't just black guys either. That's the whole thing of it. That's why so many more people are pissed. It's because now the cops treat everybody the way that they used to only treat blacks and get away with it. And people would think, white people, the majority, would think, well, hey, at least it ain't us. Right, like that Richard Pryor bit. It was mostly right, not completely right, but that Richard Pryor bit where he says, well, I can't even repeat it because of the N-word in it and whatever. But the first part is, to you white people, the police officer is Officer Timpson, and he's on your bowling league, and you know him from the neighborhood. Hi, Officer Timpson. But then to a black guy, it's N-word. Get out of the car! Bank was robbed around the block. Look just like you! Yeah. Anyway, so now that's everybody. Now they just kill whoever they want. Every day they kill somebody, the cops. And the thing of it is, so I am afraid of them, but then again, that's my whole thing about doing this show, is trying to say to people, like, hey, it could get a lot worse, and fight back while you still can, you know? And I don't mean like jackass that shot the TSA agent in LA the other day. I mean, I don't know what kind of political action to recommend. None of it involves murder, stupid. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe people, you know what, honestly, if I knew when I was younger, the way things would go, I would do things a little bit different. I guess I thought that there would be a complete economic collapse and, you know, all that martial law, FEMA camp crap back in 1999 or whatever. Back when, you know, as soon as the dot-com thing falls apart, we're all in deep trouble. I thought way back then. And I was stupid and wrong, but at least I realized it and kind of corrected my mistakes and my mistaken assumptions then. But, the point being that if I had known how much time I had, I might have taken some different paths. You know, I don't know exactly what I would have done differently, but, and I'm not one to necessarily recommend political action, but I'm not one to necessarily recommend against it either. I mean, you could well be the best Democrat and the most influential one in your party, in your town, or the most influential Tea Party leader, or the most influential of the more centrist fiscal conservative types, or the whatever the hells. You could join your party and have some effect. I don't think you should try to seize the ring of power and kill everybody with it, but there are ways to fight back within the system. My best idea, of course, is just to try to participate in the media and try to, you know, in my own small way, try to help create a climate where people just no longer believe in the state and its murderers' PR agents anymore, that we'll stop being the demand for their supply of security services that they keep insisting we all want so bad, and maybe we can have a brighter day that way. That's the best I know how to do. I wish I was a better writer. I would have more of effect that way, I guess. I don't know, but there are things that people can do to try to push back on this. Hell, look at Radley Balco. Radley Balco is a pretty good all-purpose libertarian who decided, you know what, blam, I'm going to focus like a laser on the militarization of the cops. He wrote a book, and he wrote 100 op-eds for 100 newspapers, and he's going around, and I don't know exactly if laws are being repealed or reforms are being put in place or whatever, but he is certainly single-handedly, well, not single-handedly, but he is changing the culture. He is influencing the culture of this country. Will Grigg is the same way. I think probably not as quite as successfully as Radley Balco, just because Balco's made a really big splash over there with Cato and the Huffington Post and all that behind him. And he doesn't take radical anarchist positions on every little thing, so he can argue in the language of typical Republicans and Democrats about, of course we need police, we just don't need them to be soldiers. Which is, you know, not perfect, but it's a hell of a lot better than, oops, I was going to turn the volume off on that, but I forgot. It's a hell of a lot better than what we got now and what so many others are arguing. He's changing the political conversation in America, as Rick McGinnis would say. And so things can be done, and it's got to be done. People have to push back against this because, I mean, hell, is that how you want to die? Just on a fluke, a cop shoots you in the head just for no reason because he's trained he can kill whoever he feels like and get away with it? I want to die old age on the porch in the rocking chair, man. Isn't that what we're all trying to do here? Oh, yeah, and can I point out the hypocrisy of everyone on TV news crying all day about the Toronto mayor smoking crack? Every one of these goons on TV does coke up the nose. All of them. I know a guy that used to buy coke from Shepard Smith. Oh, but the white mayor of Toronto smoked it the way black guys like prefer to consume cocaine. And so, boy, that's kind of out of order, huh, everybody? Stupid. All a bunch of cokeheads. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And man, I had so much stuff I wanted to talk about today that I didn't get a chance to talk about because of all my ranting and raving about the cops. Oh, well. That's what tomorrow's for. Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. Whole show archives, too, but the interview archives I brag about because there's more than 3,000 of them there now. ScottHorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. Okay, our next guest is Jeffrey K. He writes at dissenter.fireddoglake.com. And what is this error establishing a database connection? Uh-oh. Something is wrong with dissenter.fireddoglake.com. But anyway, soon it'll be fixed, and that's where he writes. And he's a psychologist from San Francisco and actually treats torture victims, I have recently come to understand. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott.
I didn't realize before. I only just it was actually in your Fire Dog Lake bio. It mentions there that you actually treat torture victims. Maybe that's something we can talk about a little bit later in the show. Well, but do I have that right?
Yeah, I did. I'm not currently doing that. Okay. I used to work as a volunteer clinician for Survivors International, a torture treatment center. I did that for 10 years or so.
Wow.
But I'm not currently working with them. So.
Okay. Well, I think we're probably going to get back to that maybe a little bit more. But let's start with the headlines here. Have you had a chance to read this report by the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers about the CIA's use of doctors in torturing their captives in the terror war?
Yes, I have. I've been aware of the report since I first heard about it over a year ago, and I've been waiting with bated breath for it to come out because it was going to be... It promised to be, and in fact did turn out to be, a comprehensive look at how doctors and psychologists and other health professionals were used by the CIA and also the Department of Defense, of course, in both constructing and running and operating their torture programs. And so, they did this, and the report describes how they did this in minute detail.
And now, so does it start then with Jessen and Mitchell and the Seer and all that stuff, or how's it go?
Well, Jessen and Mitchell, you know, were just, are certainly discussed. And in fact, at the very end of the report is a legal document that was made in a filing against Mitchell in the state of Texas for malpractice to have his license taken away. He's a licensed psychologist for his involvement in the torture program, but that was thrown out of the state hearings, thrown out of the state board. Wouldn't take that up, and in fact, a big part of the report takes up how there has been no accountability at federal or state or local levels for people identified as involved in the torture program.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, the Mitchell and Jessen really, although they've gotten the headlines, are just one part of what in fact has been an extensive program of torture and CIA and DOD interrogation that has utilized doctors all along the road, and not just in interrogation, but for instance, in the forced feeding of detainees, prisoners at Guantanamo, just all over the board. Doctors have been there monitoring and involved in abuse on detainees throughout the whole war on terror. So it's not just Mitchell and Jessen. So in a sense, Mitchell and Jessen are just two characters among many. In this report, doesn't focus on them particularly.
Yeah, they were just the guys who kind of, I guess the way I understood it was that the CIA went to them, or they volunteered themselves as, you know, we will help you design the program, not that they were the ones in charge of implementing all of it or anything.
Yeah, it's my understanding that the CIA really went to them, but story got dropped a long time ago. There are a lot of things that have not been reported yet and still aren't known exactly how Bush's enhanced interrogation program, the one that used waterboarding, putting people in coffins and, torturing them with insects, et cetera, really got started. That still remains to be told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know that... I know the sketch of what we don't know, in a sense, right? Like, some of this came from the Seer manual and reverse engineering the Seer stuff, but quite a bit of it started before that, and you had different levels of torture and different kind of programs of how to implement even the same tortures in different places. Like, Afghanistan had some rules, and Guantanamo others, and then different sets of rules sort of were imported from Afghanistan and Guantanamo to Iraq and applied in different ways by different forces. And so, yeah, it's certainly a mess. A lot of people screaming in agony throughout all that mumbo jumbo. But
yeah, yes. I traced back in my writings, and I published on this at Jason Leopold's The Public Record. I'm not sure if it was posted at the dissenter.
that, you know, behavioral scientists working for the U.S. government were studying SEER kinds of survival school torture techniques all the way back in the 1950s as part of the MK Ultra program, and associated programs. And they came up with a protocol, which, in fact, the new report by the Institute on Medicine as a Profession and the Open Society Foundation's report, which is what we're talking about here, talks about how, at the bottom of all this, the government's torture program tries to instill into prisoners something called dependency, debility, and dread, the three Ds. These three Ds are used to break down individuals by making them debilitated, in other words, weakened, totally dependent upon their captors psychologically as well, and they do this also by instilling dread or great fear into them. And if you think about all the different ways and all the different torture techniques you hear about, from isolation of prisoners to the use of the waterboard, all of those techniques are aimed one way or another at establishing that state of mind, that state of total mental breakdown, which is the three Ds. And that was established in an article written by a president of the American Psychological Association, Harry Harlow, back in the 1950s, along with a couple of co-authors who wrote about the three Ds, dependency, debility, and dread. And this has been, and that was taken, that research was done, as the article itself said, published in 1956, you know, by research at Air Force Survival School, you know, where they were looking at mock torture trials. So this goes back a long, long time.
Well, Alfred McCoy, in his book, A Question of Torture, says that, you know, if at any point they were taking North Korean communist techniques imported from China, imported from Russia, and applying them at SEER, as SEER, the training, how to survive torture, and then reverse engineering that into how to torture people, they're really all just copying the Nazis, because the Americans and the Soviets copied the Nazis' torture techniques, and that was where the Soviet techniques originally came from, that the North Koreans were copying, that the Americans were copying from the North Koreans.
Well, you know, yes, they you know, the Nazis, but also, it isn't well known, also the Japanese.
Part of it is the no-touch torture, right? Hey, look, Judge, there's not a bruise on him. All I did was just sensory deprivation until he had six personalities, none of which made any sense.
That was not, you know, that is the Americans' unique contribution, as McCoy himself has noted. Deep research into sensory deprivation and how it works and how you can use it with other types of torture techniques was solely an invention of the Americans, trusted at the very beginning by another president of the American Psychological Association, Donald Hebb, H-E-B-B, very famous psychologist, who began, and then, but later others took up this work, and that kind of research funded by the government went on for about 25 years, quite intensely.
Now, I almost couldn't believe this, except it sounds so ridiculous, it's got to be true, that The Guardian writes here that medical professionals were in effect told their ethical mantra, first do no harm, did not apply because they were not treating people who were ill. So, this isn't part of your medical practice, Doc. You're just helping us torture someone. Now, get to it.
Yes. Right. That was what one of the documents said. Yeah, and in fact, apologists for this kind of work by medical professionals for the government, turning them into one of the people in the one of the primary members of the task force called Agents of the Military, right? That's what the idea was. And what they did is they gave lip service to legal standards of treatment of prisoners. Of course, these legal standards were all rewritten by the Bush and Cheney people. And then they said, well, we're going to follow these legal standards, and therefore everything's cool. But what the report's main point is, the legal standards totally disregarded the ethical standards of the profession, going all the way back to the Hippocratic Oath, which says, of course, that, you know, one will not harm, first of all, anyone that you come in contact with. That's a holy oath that every medical professional takes. And, of course, the government threw that out the window. And you know, it's still, that is primarily the center of how that is affected now is through something called the Behavioral Science Consultation Teams of the Department of Defense, and through the doctors who are working on the at Guantanamo and other bases like that, and particularly with the forced feeding of detainees, which totally goes against medical protocols and medical ethics. But, you know, the government says it's legal because they say they can say it. Whatever they say is legal is because they say it.
Right. Well, and the problem is, really, is that people really believe that, especially in the case of the military, that, you know, after all, if you dress up in green and you're fighting for your country and your enemy is the Nazis or Osama bin Laden or something, then they can give you a license to kill people. I mean, hell, they legalized the occupation of Iraq and the causing of a civil war that killed at least multiple hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. If they can do that, and if that isn't sin, as long as you're doing it under terms of government employment, then what's wrong with drowning someone half to death a few times, you know?
Right, absolutely. You know, it's mind-boggling the way in which they twisted you know, the law and medical ethics that had been laid down for decades, if not centuries, you know, and a lot of this, the report, if you read it, which can be found online, there's a link at the dissenter, but you can go to the website of the Institute for Medicine as a Profession, IMAP, I think it's just imap.com or .org, and actually download the report.
It's actually at imapny.org.
Ah, okay.
IMAPNY, thanks. Institute on Medicine as a Profession.
Yes.
It's called Medical, Military, and Ethics Experts. Oh, no, that's just the press release. I'm sorry.
Oh.
The task force report is Ethics Abandoned, Medical yes. Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the report is some, you know, a couple hundred pages long or more, and it goes into great detail showing how a lot of this, of these changes were made by deft and never, little reported or unreported changes in regulations, rules, little known documents, not ones that are secret, mind you, they're there, you could find them. Oftentimes these things are released, but people don't read them about, you know, procedures for medical professionals and Department of Defense code number 50, blah, 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 you know, whatever. No one reads it. Even in the military, they don't apparently read it. But it gave them the, and then they lied, by the way, to, you know, when they would get caught out, they'd lie and say, oh, no, we're setting up ways in which people can report abuse. You know, we definitely don't want this. These are rogue elements, right? The bad apples at Abu Ghraib. And, you know, they can report this up the chain of command. But then, you know, they never talked, actually gave the medical people in charge any procedures about how to really do that. And nor would they define it, nor did they give any training to doctors and others. Instead, they would fill them up with propaganda about these people being the worst of the worst. And if you're, you know, in the military, you know, and it's drummed into you that you have to follow orders. And so it's, and then on the other side of the spectrum, the non-military, you had the American Psychological Association, one of the top medical professional associations, you know, telling their people, pretty much similar to the way CIA and DOD was, well, we don't torture, we don't want you to torture, we want you to report torture, but we also think, and this is a key aspect of this report, we also think that you can be involved in interrogations. And a lot of this boils down to just how ethical is it or not for a medical professional to be involved in the interrogation of a national security, or any kind of interrogation, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here's the thing about waterboarding someone is, you don't really cut them open and make them bleed. It almost sounds even like it's not quite as bad as just punching a guy in the face a bunch of times and breaking his nose or something like that. It sounds like it could be a lot more violent. I mean, after all, a beating actually probably could be a lot more violent than waterboarding. But the thing of it is, the way I read it anyway, was the waterboarding, the simulated drowning means drowning. And that what they would do is they would have the doctor standing there with an O2 sensor on, say, Zabeda, who knew nothing's finger, Mm-hmm. And they would get him to what they call the death spiral. And then they would sit him upright, you know, when he was absolutely, his blood was completely out of oxygen. He is on his way to the gates of hell. And then, boom, they wake him back up again and, you know, sit him up straight where he can puke and take a breath. And maybe they zap him and resuscitate him that way and then do it again. So really what these doctors are doing is they're helping the CIA guys, actually like flatliners or something, murder somebody, drown them to death, basically. Over and over and over again. A dunk in the water. A no-brainer.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. The, you know, one of the implements they had is described in the CIA Inspector General report that was emergency equipment for tracheotomies. So, you know, if you're going to have an interrogation, don't forget to bring, you know, your emergency scalpel so that you can cut open the person's throat because you just drowned them. So because they were just about to die and you need to breathe, they need to breathe.
I mean, right, at which point you're treating them as a patient again and you have to start taking care of them for a minute until you go back to torturing them.
Yeah, it truly harkens back to, you know, the kinds of things that supposedly America repudiated, you know, with the Nazis at Nuremberg. Although, even that, as it turns out, everything, in fact, it was Al McCoy who once told me personally, the more you look into this, the darker it gets. It turns out that even Nuremberg, in many ways, was a hoax upon America, because at the same time that the United States was prosecuting in a military tribunal the Nazi doctors, they were giving amnesty to the Japanese doctors who were doing exactly the same thing, because they had gone even beyond the Nazis and had conducted widespread experiments on biological warfare on human beings, and they wanted that data. So they gave them all amnesty, covered it up, made sure they didn't go to trial, and some of them went to work, you know, for the Americans later. And then, meanwhile, they shipped all the data off to Fort Detrick. This is not something that I'm exposing here for the first time. I mean, there's been some books written on this, but it's primarily been kept quite hush-hush.
Yeah.
And
I think I've heard a little of that somewhere, but I sure don't know anything about it. I know, yeah, of course, about the Americans recruiting as many Nazis as they could to use against the Soviet Union and helping a lot more than that escape just for the fun of it, I guess.
Yeah, that was called Project Paperclip. And there were some other associated projects they did. They brought literally hundreds, if not thousands, of Nazis to the United States, many of whom went to go to work for NASA.
Yeah, and the CIA, too. Reinhard Gehlen was the head of anti-Soviet intelligence there for a while, believe that or not.
Right, right, and set up the German Secret Service, the West German Secret Service. So, yeah, all of this is pretty dark stuff. And this report shows...
well, never mind the fact of the nuking of and the complete burning to the ground of all of Japan and the Americans finally, you know, pitching in with the British on their civilian terror bombing of the Germans, too. I mean, the Americans admitted at the time that they knew they were war criminals, and just good thing we won.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. And for those who follow those matters, certainly those who were on trial at the various war crimes trials brought that up in their defense. They were unsuccessful because, of course, they were criminals anyway, but they were, you know, they did have a point, you know, and here we are. And, in fact, the failure to address these points one way or another is why we are where we are now, you know, still facing here in this country, you know, a crisis of mammoth proportions, because we're talking about the entire medical, you know, we're talking about a medical establishment in which hundreds of doctors who later then leave the military and the CIA, and they go to work in the government, right?
Wait, I'm sorry, Jeff, I got to interrupt you because, Jeff, I'm sorry, your phone is getting real staticky on us there. Do you happen to know why?
I think I was walking around and I went to an area where perhaps
better? Yeah, try to get back to your good spot.
I'll just stay exactly where I am.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Sorry to interrupt. What I was saying is these doctors and psychologists, they leave the military service and the spy service and they go out into the civilian world and they take with them their degraded ethics and their degraded way of treating patients, and then they later on they're teaching others in graduate schools and medical schools, and they pass on this virus of nationalism over ethics, And it's something that could really is harmful to this country.
Well, just think about if your doctor was a CIA torture doctor, you'd have no way of knowing. You could be sending your wife or your kid to a CIA torture doctor.
That's right. You could.
That's what Chalmers Johnson meant by you give up your empire, you live under it. You turn yourselves into the instruments of torture, and you are. In fact,
right.
I know a guy who his daughter... Or I guess I know a guy who knows a guy whose daughter married a former Guantanamo guard. And, you know, it's not like he was running the place or anything, but just, you know what? We sure do live in a society full of ex-Guantanamo guards, don't we? And that's just what we're turning ourselves into, is a society full of ex-Guantanamo guards. The longer we keep that thing open, the longer we keep acting like this. That's why our cops act like they just got home from Iraq. They did.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's right. That blowback from this is definitely... coming into this country, and already has, obviously. I did want to mention one other thing about this report, that the rest of the press, or most of them, I noticed Rolling Stone's account on the Ethics Abandoned report did mention this in passing, that one of the major findings, in fact, it was the number two finding and recommendation of the Ethics Abandoned Task Force report, and I wrote on this at the dissenter, that people can go look that up, has to do with... the Army Field Manual for interrogation.
Right. In fact, I just had a debate about this, a little bit of one, with Colonel Wilkerson the other day. Because,
really?
Because we were talking about McCain, and I was saying that he shouldn't get credit for being anti-torture because he sold us out on the Detainee Treatment Act. And he was saying, oh, yeah, you mean the part where they exempted the CIA because that's what Dick Cheney wanted. And I said, yeah, that, but also he just said... go by the Army Field Manual, and yes, let's go ahead and rewrite the Army Field Manual so that Appendix M allows this, that, and the other abuse. Not as bad as it was under the worst of the U regime or whatever, but still, temperature manipulation, sleep deprivation, and we can see all this still going on to this day at Bagram, correct?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's been a couple years now, but the Department of Defense confirmed to me when I queried their public affairs office that Appendix M interrogations were ongoing, and this was in 2010 during the Obama, you know, so certainly under Obama, you know. And you're right, the Appendix M includes methods like sleep deprivation, isolation, exploitation of fear, sensory deprivation, manipulation of the environment, manipulation of the diet. And it does all these things. It makes sure only to a certain subsection of prisoners. So if the prisoner meets the Geneva requirements of being a prisoner of war, you can't use this section of the manual on them. But if not, then you can do that. Now, what does that mean? I guess all prisoners are not equal. Some you can horribly torture, and others you have to apply Geneva techniques to. Well, that's just sick. And a lot of people, a lot of human rights organizations have spoken out about this. But President Obama continues to say that his Department of Defense and CIA using the Army Field Manual do not torture. And that's just a bold lie. And, you know, I've been too quiet, perhaps, myself in saying what really needs to be said. If it is true, as this report says, and I will quote, the Army Field Manual on Human Intelligence Collector Operations, which binds both military and CIA interrogators, permits methods of interrogation that are recognized under international law as forms of torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Well, then that means Barack Obama is a torturer, just as George Bush was. And that,
yeah,
I'm sorry if people don't like that. I'm sorry if it freaks them out. But that's just the truth. He has pushed the Army Field Manual, and I believe this is because he does so because the CIA and the Department of Defense tell him to do that, because their main thing is to cover up torture. And they've done that by putting out a cover story that the Army Field Manual is non-abusive. I got into it with Charlie Savage of the New York Times on Twitter the other day because he put out a story saying that the Army Field Manual is non-abusive, and I said that he and the New York Times were pushing a lie, and he threatened to block me from my, quote, lying rant on Twitter.
Wow.
About lies. And then he said something that wasn't true about Appendix M. It was only for separating detainees from each other for safety reasons, which is a total lie.
Yeah,
so,
no, I'm surprised to hear that from him, actually. I generally respect his work, but
well,
that's way off. And anybody can just Google Bagram and Appendix M and know better than that in one instant.
Yeah, it's
not like this is top secret.
It's shocking to me too, and I don't know. It's strange to me that people like Savage, but Savage Blood by no means is alone. You will not find, with the exception of maybe Marcy Wheeler and Jason Leopold, anybody out there in the blogging world,
yeah,
the blogosphere, that talks about this.
Yeah, other Scott Horton is good on this, but he's MIA right now. Daphne Evyatar is typically pretty good, although I haven't heard from her in a while either.
That's true. Oh, what's that?
Yeah. All right. Hey, listen. Taxi's playing. That means we got to go. Thanks, Jeff. I sure appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right. And for whatever reason, I was having trouble. It's over now. Dissenter.FiredogLake.com. Dissenter.FiredogLake.com. For Jeff K., Blue Ribbon Task Force says Army Field Manual on Interrogation allows torture abuse. See you tomorrow. Thanks.